Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Friday, the 24th of March. Most of tonight's programme comes from Brussels, where on the eve of events to mark the 60th anniversary of the Treaty of Rome, Ritterler has been considering the future of the European Union. We do have one other story, so much for the art of the deal. As Donald Trump pulls the plug on his promised healthcare plan after opposition from Republicans in Congress, we'll be asking how big a blow is it to the president's prestige. This was Donald Trump's prediction on the campaign trail.
When we win on November 8th, and elect a Republican Congress, we will be able to immediately repeal and replace Obamacare. Have to do it.
Have to do it, he said, but they didn't do it, not today at least. Here's what happened in the U.S. House of Representatives a few hours ago.
Pursuant to Clause 12A of Rule 1, the chair declares the House in recess subject to the call of the chair.
That groaning you heard is the sound of a major legislative anticlimax as the plug was pulled on the American Health Care Act, the Trump administration's alternative to Obamacare. After days of twisting the arms of reluctant Republican members of Congress, the president had insisted that the bill went forward for a vote today. But if his intention was to call his colleagues bluff, it failed. There was no artful deal, no last-minute rush of Republicans to support the proposal. No point, the White House judged, in holding a vote they couldn't win. The Republican Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, publicly took the defeat on the chin.
You've all heard me say this before. Moving from an opposition party to a governing party comes with growing pains. And, well, we're feeling those growing pains today. We came really close today, but we came up short. I spoke to the president just a little while ago, and I told him that the best thing I think to do is to pull this bill, and he agreed with that decision. I will not sugarcoat this. This is a disappointing day for us.
Speaking to reporters at the White House a bit later, President Trump acknowledged that he was disappointed too, but he blamed Democrats for failing to work with Republicans on the bill, and he had this optimistic spin on events.
Perhaps the best thing that could happen is exactly what happened today, because we'll end up with a truly great health care bill in the future after this mess known as Obamacare explodes. We all learned a lot. We learned a lot about loyalty. We learned a lot about the vote-getting process. We learned a lot about some very arcane rules. So it's been, certainly for me, it's been a very interesting experience.
An interesting and a learning experience for the president. Let's speak to the BBC's Laura Bicker, who is in Congress for us. So, Laura, talk us through a pretty dramatic day.
Yep, after all the drama came the defeat and the disappointment. You could see it in the faces of the Republicans. They were handed an ultimatum. They were told vote for change or there would be no change. And that's exactly what they have. Obamacare is still intact. It is still the law of the land, despite having this bill right in front of them that they could have voted on. In the end, voting on it would have been a humiliating defeat for the Republicans. However, what they have to do is now walk away, and you've heard from Paul Ryan there, he'll be licking his wounds this weekend. He did give a very candid admission about the growing pains of his government. This is the first time in 8 years that they've held such power, both here in the House, the Senate and at the White House. And he admitted that the last 8 years in opposition, all they had to do was disagree with Democrats. Now they have to agree with one another. And when it came to this bill, they simply couldn't do that.
So if the vote had gone ahead, you say it would have been a humiliating defeat for the Republicans. What about the fact it didn't go ahead? How much of a defeat is that for President Trump?
President Trump really has been the president who says he could get a deal done. The reason many people elected him is because they saw him as a businessman, somebody who could go behind the scenes, not just twist arms, but break them, getting the deal done. He's even written a book called The Art of the Deal. And yet, when it came to the first test of his presidency, the first test of him as a politician, despite being here all week, he has failed. It is an embarrassing setback, but he's trying to push the blame away. He's trying to say, look, the Democrats didn't agree with us. And he's trying to say, look, Obamacare will eventually fail, and then what will we all do? But in the middle of all this, despite all the politics, you have millions of Americans who are now looking at their healthcare and wondering what it means for them.
He's saying he's going to move on. He's going to deal with tax reform now. Does he have more of a chance of getting something through with that?
There is more of a consensus amongst the Republicans on tax reform, but it won't be easy by any means, because there are still things that the likes of the very right-wing part of the party want that the left-wing part of the Republicans don't. For instance, when it came to this healthcare bill, moderates felt that the reforms went too far, that it felt it left too many people without insurance. But on the right of the party, when it came to this bill, they felt that the reforms didn't go far enough. They wanted to take the hand of government away from healthcare, something so personal. So when it comes to tax reform, how will they agree on that, and how will he get them all on the same page? He certainly can't afford a second defeat.
Laura Bicker, thanks very much. Well, Ron Christie is a Republican strategist, a former advisor to President George W. Bush. So why did this effort fail?
Because I think there's too much of a schism between the 46 or so members of the House Freedom Caucus, the most conservative wing, and about the 40 to 50 members of the House Tuesday group, the more moderate members hailing from most urban areas in the United States. And Speaker Ryan had a very, very delicate tightrope to walk. He could only afford to lose 22 votes to deliver the bill to the Senate. And most vote tallies had that at 40 and some as high as even 50 that they were going to lose. And ultimately, that's why they decided to pull the bill from further consideration.
This followed days of attempts by the White House to negotiate, to get more Republicans on board. What does the manner in which that effort was carried out tell you?
It tells me that they tried to do everything a little bit too quickly. And it also tells me that putting the building blocks of this legislation together, they failed to garner consensus from the outset. So back in 2001, when President Bush, when I was working with him and he got his signature education bill together, he found a way to work with Republicans and Democrats, moderates and conservatives, and said, here are my principles for reform, but I need all of you on board. And from the outset in the present case, it was very clear that President Trump wanted to pass a bill with only conservative members. And for many conservatives, it wasn't far enough. And for most of the moderates, they thought it went too far too soon.
So as far as President Trump's image is concerned, how bad does this look?
It's an embarrassment, to be certain. I mean, you can't campaign for a year and a half and say this is what you want to do. And you have the largest Republican majority in the United States Congress since 1929, and you're unable to bring a bill to the floor to sign. What President Trump, I'm sure, will do is now reflect on what happened, get over the embarrassment of what undoubtedly the American media are going to skewer him on for the next several days, if not weeks to come, and recognize in the future he has to be a lot more actively engaged in the negotiation stage. And he has to actively call on members to support him, to offer concessions where necessary, and to otherwise project to the Republican caucus and the Democrats that he's there to serve all the Americans, not just one wing of one party.
What about all those Americans who voted for Donald Trump because they don't like Obamacare, because their premiums are going up, and are now hearing the president say, we've given it a go, we're just going to wait for Obamacare to wither on the vine? What are they going to say?
No, they're furious. I've spoken to several already today. They're saying, this is why I voted for President Trump. This is what I wanted President Trump to do, and he failed to deliver in less than 100 days. What does that mean for the rest of his administration? Now, I will give the president a lot more latitude, having worked in the White House for 4 years and on Capitol Hill for nine. It can be a very sticky process, but the president needs to regroup in a hurry and recognize that for all of those who thought they were going to get their promises answered, their prayers answered, he needs to deliver for them as well as the entire American populace who he's honored to represent.
The Republican strategist Ron Christie. Theresa May will be conspicuous by her absence tomorrow when EU leaders celebrate the 60th anniversary of the signing of the Treaty of Rome. But The World Tonight does have a presence in Brussels. Rittel has gone there to discuss the future of the European Union and to remind us about its past.
In March 1957, the Treaty of Rome was signed by France, the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, Italy and Germany, establishing the European Economic Community and, of course, the European Atomic Agency. In its preamble, the treaty stated that the signatories were determined to lay the foundations of an ever closer union among the peoples of Europe. Instead, 60 years on, the European Union is facing fundamental questions about its future. The UK didn't sign that original treaty, but hard on the heels of this 60th anniversary, the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, will trigger the negotiations leading to Brexit. And as if the departure of the UK wasn't bad enough, there are other pressing problems for the EU too. The challenge of mass migration, the economic legacy of the crisis in the Eurozone, the rise of populist anti-EU politicians, the rejection of globalisation and an increasingly unpredictable Russia. All these things threaten to weaken the EU, if not tear it apart. On tonight's programme, we're going to consider where the future of the EU lies in this time of upheaval with a panel of EU insiders. Dr. Heather Graeber is the director of the Open Society European Policy Institute and was an advisor to the European Commissioner responsible for enlargement between 2004 and 2009. Daniel Hannan is a Conservative member of the European Parliament, a steadfast campaigner for Brexit. Guntram Wolff is director of Bruegel, which is a European economic research organisation, and a former economist at the European Commission. And Tomáš Valášek is the Slovak ambassador to NATO, and he's shortly going to become the director of our hosts here today, Carnegie Europe. Welcome to you all. Before we hear from each of you, here's a brief reminder of the signing of the Treaty of Rome.
Giungono all'aeroporto di Ciampino il ministro degli esteri belga Paul-Henri Spaak e il suo collega lussemburghese Beck.
Italian coverage of the signing of the Treaty of Rome 60 years ago. It's interesting, at the time there was no agreement about where the headquarters of the EU should be. And almost by default, it ended up being here in Brussels. Belgium began with a B. It was chosen as the first place to chair the institutions, and then they stayed here. I'm standing on the Schuman roundabout with Jeff Mead, a retired journalist. Jeff, what can we see from where we're standing?
Wherever we look, we will see one kind of European Union institutional building or another. I'm now looking at this monumental headquarters of the European Commission. Then, opposite that Commission building, we have the Council of Ministers building. More recently, behind me, we have the glass-fronted headquarters of what you might call the putative European Union Foreign Service.
So, on the side of that Commission building, there is a massive poster marking the 60th anniversary of the signing of the Treaty of Rome. Just give us a sense of the kind of optimism that surrounded this project, the EEC, as it was then, 60 years ago.
Of course there was a sense of optimism. Remember, we weren't far off the Second World War. There was that sense of the need to be united, originally to guarantee security of food supply. It wasn't a political club. It wasn't, frankly, much of an economic club.
So since the signing of that treaty 60 years ago, how would you say the mood among member states has changed?
I think it has changed. A lot of the objections raised from time to time by the Brits about too much integration, too fast, have been quietly shared by some other countries. They don't have reservations about the project per se, but what they do have problems with sometimes is interference, is the European Commission's intention to keep bringing forward legislation. And certainly there is a sense that for some it has grown too big. 28 member states is a lot. And people began to say then, well, that's crazy. How many days do you now need to meet for every member state to have their say?
Jeff Mead, who's been reporting Europe from Brussels since 1979, setting out some of the issues. We'll explore all of that in more detail. I think it's fair to say perhaps one of the most obvious and pressing of the challenges is that of Brexit. Theresa May is due to trigger Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty next Wednesday. Daniel Hannan, Michel Barnier, the EU's chief negotiator, has spoken of his desire for an orderly withdrawal, but he was less confident of Theresa May's assertion that no deal is better than a bad deal, suggesting that there could be serious consequences from leaving without an agreement. He cited, for instance, rights for British citizens in the EU and the reciprocal rights for EU citizens in the UK, and the idea that customs controls, for instance, could lead to a slowdown of trade. Is this, in your view, political posturing ahead of a tough negotiation or a real possibility?
Well, it's a statement of the obvious that no deal is better than a bad deal. I mean, that is by definition true. But I don't think that there is much likelihood that there will be a breakdown because we do have common interests. Britain has an interest, continuing interest, in the security and prosperity of its European allies. Prosperous neighbours make good customers. And these are countries which are, in any case, old friends. So I think it's likely that there will be a deal which preserves through bilateral treaty quite a lot of the impositions that are currently obligations under the treaty, provided that they continue to be in the interests of all sides. I expect all sides to act according to their their self-interest here.
Guntram Wolff, do you think there will be goodwill in that negotiation, or is there a danger that, in a sense, 27 countries gang up against one? There's a sort of a punishment element to it, something that Michel Barnier suggested won't be the case, but you could see how it might arise.
Now, I think the negotiations will, of course, be difficult, but I do have a sincere hope that at some stage there will be sense coming to policymakers on all sides. And that sense must be, of course, you cannot enjoy privileges without paying. Let's take market access. You cannot have full market access without also paying into the EU budget, to just give one example. So it needs to be a fair deal on both sides, but it should be a deal, to my mind. But I agree there's a pretty significant risk to have very unpleasant negotiations during this year at least.
Daniel Hannan, is there that realism in the UK? If you think about the way in which the relationship with the EU has been described, the nature of the deal, the nature of the future relationship has moved many times. I think during the campaign, you were one of those people who talked about the importance of perhaps maintaining some kind of single market relationship. I think you talked about a Swiss model. Actually, the conversation has moved a long way from that, hasn't it?
I'm not sure it's moved completely away from that. It was a very narrow vote. It was 48-52. And that seems to me not to amount to a mandate for a complete walking away, but rather for a phased, gradual repatriation of power with the consent wherever possible of our European allies. And I don't think this is unrealistic. Had David Cameron come back with any retrieval of power in February of 2016, I think the result could have been different. You know, it would have only taken one person in 50 to vote another way. And in a way, of course, perfectly within their rights, the other countries, to say, well, we're not prepared to make any repatriations of power, you know, we're committed to ever closer union. Britain always wanted a relationship with the rest of the EU that was a common market, not a common government. If we couldn't get that looser membership as a member, we will now look for it from the outside.
Heather Graby, one specific aspect of that negotiation, such as it was that the concerns that were articulated by David Cameron about the free movement of people are probably now shared by quite a few EU countries. I mean, it seems a bit ironic that something that was flagged up by the UK is now probably a much wider concern across the EU, just as the UK is about to leave.
Britain could have had a lot of alliances on this issue if David Cameron had gone out and tried to forge partnerships with other countries who shared many similar views on, for example, the access of workers to benefits or how those benefits should apply to family members and so on. But he didn't choose to do that. And so as a result, this issue is now frozen until Brexit is finished.
He spent 2 years trying to do that.
And where are the alliances? Where are the partnerships that he built?
In the event, despite all of the private warmth that he was getting from individual member governments, the European Union was not prepared to make any significant return of power.
This is not what the issue was about. What I'm talking about is the dynamics between the member states. There were a number of different concerns and interests in it. And I think at that time, he could have formed really quite good strategic alliances if he'd actually gone out and done that homework with the countries.
His ministers were
but now it's impossible to have that debate in the open because of the fear of setting precedents. And I think that's actually a very important point about the Brexit negotiations, that it actually makes it harder for the EU27 to discuss important issues among themselves. And that matters a great deal in terms of the huge challenges from outside the EU that they need to deal with.
I'm going to move on. Another fault line that is part of the structure of the EU is that of the Eurozone. 19 of the EU 28 are members, and there are those who argue that in the wake of the crisis, that for the Eurozone to prosper, its members must accept more integration. But in the meantime, austerity has left a lingering disenchantment with the whole European project among some countries of the Eurozone. Kostas Kalergas has spent a rainy day in a Greek village that has been deeply affected by the crisis.
Below the green slopes of Mount Parnassus in central Greece lies Davlia, a settlement inhabited since antiquity. As I walk through the narrow streets of the village, I pass by remnants of a once vibrant community. Closed shops, uninhabited houses, and the abandoned building of the old local district court, one of the 150 courthouses from around the country that were closed in 2012 as part of an effort to cut down public spending.
I am at the office of Panagiotis Tournaras, head of Davlia's community. Mr. Tournaras, how is life here during the crisis?
The main problem is the economic one, because a lot of people have lost their jobs during the past 7 years. The majority of young people are leaving in order to find jobs in bigger cities.
According to your own opinion, who is responsible for the crisis?
We can't blame a single person for it. The politicians bear some responsibility, but the citizens bear responsibility too. When the European Union and the Euro first came to our lives, we welcomed them with enthusiasm. We welcome them as something good for the country. Right now, the simple citizens, the pensioner, the worker, the farmer, hear the name EU and start swearing.
Together with Yorgos, Panagiotis' father, we are driving towards his farm where he has his sheep and cows.
You have to work no matter if you are healthy or about to die. The animal feed is expensive. The price of medicines has been increased. The seeds, too. And we sell the meat almost for free. This year, we got 4 euros per kilo for the lambs. 4 euros!
As with almost every mountain village in Greece, the center of the settlement is a square, with a plane tree and at least one coffee shop. Davlia used to have 6. Dimitris Miroyanis owns one of the 2 remaining ones.
We don't work to earn money. We simply keep our shops open so that we say we are working. The people will always go out. But the people who go out are spending so little money that we cannot keep the shop open.
Do you think the decision makers in Brussels represent you?
Of course not. These people seem to me as if they hate Greece and as if they want to destroy us.
Kostas Kalergis reporting. Guntram Wolf, the Greek situation, it could be described as perilous. There's concerns of a default in July when Athens' next debt repayment is scheduled. The backdrop, though, is an increasingly tight German election race. It's rather difficult for Chancellor Merkel, perhaps, to persuade reluctant German voters to spend more money on bailouts for the Greeks. And at the same time, you've got the Trump administration signalling that it doesn't want the IMF to spend its money on a bailout either. So is a Grexit on the cards?
I don't think Grexit is currently on the cards, but I mean, definitely the Greek issue remains an unresolved problem of the Eurozone. There should have been an earlier debt restructuring. Doing a debt restructuring now is painfully difficult and sets precedence of the nature of this monetary union. So is it a monetary union where real transfer of resources happen from taxpayers in some countries to others?
Well, if it's a genuine union, why shouldn't that be possible?
I think the way the Eurozone was set up in the Maastricht Treaty, arguably in a faulty way, was to say there will never be any transfers. And so the political consensus of monetary union was founded on the principle of no transfers. Now, I do think that actually the question whether we can move one step further in terms of really allowing countries to go bust and, you know, impose some losses on private creditors is an absolutely fundamental question.
But if we're talking about repairing the euro or propping the euro up, however you want to describe it, Tomáš Hlaváček, is the only answer deeper integration?
Well, this is a point where I think I'll agree with Daniel. There is a limit to what is politically sustainable. There is a limit to what is popular. And after all, EU member states are all democracies. You have to work with a democratic mandate.
But in a sense, the kind of transfers of money, literally, that you're going to need or continue to need, it seems, from north to south, how do you get round that? What's the answer?
But equally, you know, let's not forget that departure of Greece from the Eurozone presents a massive political problem for the rest of the EU member states as well. The reality is, and I suspect Daniel will strongly agree, that a number of governments have put their political future on the line by saying that the loans to Greece are just that, loans. They have therefore created the expectation that they will be repaid. So the interest in Greece not defaulting, not leaving the euro, is shared by a number of EU member states. And there's arguably almost no end to the financial cost that they're willing to pay, because the alternative is a real political pain.
Daniel Hannan, what has the Eurozone crisis, in a sense, revealed about the relationship between, if you like, the European political elites and the people of Europe, whether they're in Greece or in Germany?
It's revealed the pitiless way in which policymakers in Brussels are indifferent to the suffering caused by their policies. I was in Greece just before Christmas, working as a volunteer on a project with homeless people in Athens. The immiseration of Greece has to be seen to be believed. 7 years now, and GDP is still 80% below what it was before the crisis. Can anyone seriously doubt that it would have been better for Greece to have defaulted and decoupled cleanly 7 years ago, rather than put itself through all of this, always with the promise from the ECB, from the Commission, that it was about to turn the corner, that just one more round of austerity would lead to the economy picking up again? Every year, the same false prediction. The Brussels elites were prepared to inflict poverty, unemployment and emigration on millions of people around southern Europe. And I think that has led to a complete change in the way in which people perceive the EU.
Heather Graby, it has affected how people see the EU, hasn't it, across the union?
Yeah, the euro crisis has had a hugely traumatic effect on many people because after the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the financial crisis, the effects in the EU were much amplified by the fact that there was this incomplete construction. But these were not decisions taken by faceless bureaucrats in Brussels. These were decisions taken by sovereign governments in a negotiation, including the Greek government. The idea that somehow this was pitilessly imposed by people in Brussels. No, these were decisions taken in the European Council by democratically elected heads of state and government. Now, I would disagree with a number of those decisions that they took, and I think they didn't go anything like far enough in providing the Eurozone with the infrastructure it really needs. But they were decisions taken by leaders, which they had to defend in front of their own parliaments. This was an entirely democratic process.
But hasn't the consequence been to fuel this anti-globalisation, anti-EU, anti-politics agenda that you're seeing across Europe now?
Yes, what we see is a crisis of representative democracy, and not only in Europe, but also in the United States, in Australia. People are very dissatisfied with what politics now delivers, and the idea that politicians have become an elite that is very detached from the people is a very common concern across many democracies in the world. The way it's become more intense in Europe is because you've also got the European Union as a supranational level of government, and so it's easier to blame the EU because people are less familiar with it, because it's further away. But it's basically suffering from the same structural problem that you see everywhere, which is people don't trust elites to represent them anymore. And they're very worried about what they see as major international forces of globalization and economic trends that they can't control. So you just see a more intense version of what's there in politics all over the place.
You're listening to a special edition of The World Tonight, recorded at the Carnegie Europe think tank in Brussels. Let's move to America, a little bit anyway. The Trump presidency has raised questions about the US commitment to EU security and has also made it plain that America expects European states to increase their military spending. And this comes as concerns grow about Russia's intentions. The invasion of Ukraine's left many of Russia's near neighbours wary about what Moscow may do next. Sweden, which isn't a member of NATO, is reintroducing conscription for men and women. Permanent troops have been returned to its island Gotland, which lies between Sweden and the Baltic states. And last week, the government announced a £50 million boost to this year's defence budget. The BBC's Maddie Savage has been to Sweden's military headquarters in Stockholm.
Security is as tight as you would expect here. I had to email over a copy of my passport before I arrived. I've just had the hard copy checked. And now I can head inside to meet Brigadier General Michael Klaassen. He's Deputy Head of Policy and Planning with a focus on the military's long-term strategy. Hi. Hi, Michael. Nice to meet you. So, Michael, first things first, there's a lot of global talk about tensions in the Baltic region. Can you give us some specific examples of what's going on and why Sweden is so concerned?
It's no secret at all that a lot of this started with a different posture taken by Russia in terms of military presence, the type and the number of exercises held in the area, the weapon systems brought in and put at display in this area are all part of an overall deteriorated security situation as we see it.
How important do you think the role of the EU is going forward during these tense times?
Immense importance, not the least because we are facing new types of threats, which cannot only be addressed by military means. We need to address all relevant security threats with a certain level of commonality between European countries or like-minded countries.
How likely do you think it is that there will be conflict in the region?
I think that, we cannot exclude it, and that's enough for me as a military.
Sweden recently celebrated 200 years of peace. So how worried are locals? I've been speaking to people in Stockholm's Stadion district, close to the army's headquarters.
It's a little bit scary with Putin because we don't know. I mean, he went into Ukraine. We don't know what he wants to do with the rest of Europe.
Do you feel more scared now than a couple of years ago? Have you felt a shift?
Yeah, a little bit more concerned. Of course, it's nice to be neutral, as we have been for a long, long, long time. But we need to increase the defence spending because it has been quite low.
I don't think Russia's a big threat, and the money could be spent on other things as healthcare and school and like the police.
One further ongoing debate is whether or not Sweden should join its Baltic neighbours in NATO in the face of rising tensions in the region. The current centre-left Green government is strongly opposed to the idea, but centre-right parties are more in favour, and there's an election coming up next year.
Maddie Savage in Stockholm. Tomasz Vlasic, you're still a diplomat at NATO. How do you view security for the EU and that relationship with Russia?
I think it's harder to disagree with the characterization of the times we live in as possibly more dangerous than any point since the end of the Cold War. Russia appears to have concluded that the current security order in Europe is both unfair to it and be vulnerable, and therefore it seems to have redoubled efforts to turn it upside down. And therefore the Swedish decision to increase defense spending, given their position, given their vulnerability, makes an awful lot of sense. But the EU role is underestimated, precisely because the nature of the challenges we're looking at, the tactics have changed. So much of the attempt to undermine the security order happens not in a form of military force, but happens in a form of disinformatia, happens in a form of trying to subvert the democratic order within our own countries by encouraging and directly funding occasionally populist extremist parties. The responses often will lie completely outside the military domain. This will lie, some of them will be, most of them frankly, will be within the nation states. But some of them will lie within the European Union. For example, it was the European Union, not NATO, that has set up a unit to monitor Russian propaganda and disinformation aimed at EU member states, and actually is trying with a credible and effective attempt to counter the propaganda by putting out facts.
Daniel Hannan, disinformation, cybersecurity attacks, perhaps, are these exactly the kind of threats where an organisation, be it the European Union or indeed NATO, is actually rather better placed to act than individual nation states?
I mean, I think Tomasz describes the problem very eloquently and very well. Britain is completely committed to the defence of Europe. Last week, we had the first deployment of UK servicemen to the defence of Estonia, riflemen and hussars. That was a decision that was taken and announced during the referendum, and no one, to my knowledge, criticised it. It was a completely uncontentious decision, because withdrawing from the EU does not mean turning our backs on our allies. I think that was understood across all sides. And sure, of course, this is a situation where countries will work together. That is not synonymous with saying that the European Commission will be in charge.
Guntram Wolf, should European nations be prepared to spend more, as the Americans clearly want European nations to do?
Well, I think we are certainly falling short of the requirements and the commitments in NATO, which is the 2% target. And I think if you look at the structure of military spending, what you see is that major countries such as Germany spend actually very little on equipment. And we know that equipment is hugely important to have an effective defense. You cannot just pay personnel, you actually have to give them the right equipment. So I think there's certainly scope for increasing military spending in Germany and other countries. Now, the question is, how do you do it and what kind of structure so that it doesn't raise fears among neighbors? And don't forget that low military spending in Germany was very much desired for a very long time, right? And I think for good reasons, frankly speaking. And so I do think we need to think very carefully about what kind of structure can we build so that German military power would be bound in Europe. Now, be that the European Union or be it bilateral agreements between several member states, I don't think the European Union has to be the primary driver here. But I do think it's very important to think, how is military power developed and then organized in the European Union?
Tomasz, one last point before we move on. If you're in Central and Eastern Europe, if you're in France and Germany, do you view the EU through a different prism when it comes to defence, security, its role, and your relationship to it?
Yes, you do. That's only inevitable. Geography, history, these all play a role in shaping national strategic cultures. So at the risk of stereotyping, what you find, particularly in parts of Central and Eastern Europe, is a far greater importance being attached to NATO, simply because the sort of risks and scenarios countries in a region worry about tend to have to do with a large conventional war between two peer adversaries. That's a slang word for two large modern powers such as Russia and one of the Western countries. And it's hard to imagine that scenario being managed successfully and effectively without the United States on your side. When you look elsewhere in Europe, the things that are top on the minds of people in, say, Lisbon or in Rome, understandably different concerns. Further away from Russia, they're looking possibly at migration, almost certainly at terrorism as their primary concern. And there often the EU can be far more helpful than NATO. So you see very different emotional attachment and a very different importance and degree of importance being attached to EU and NATO as a security actor, depending on where you come from.
I'm going to ask you each one concluding thought, which is essentially, where will the EU be 60 years from now? Will it be even? Guntram.
Well, I think the EU 60 years from now will be certainly a very different animal than it is currently. It will have different levels of integration. It will have some that have moved more forward. It will either have fixed the Eurozone problems that we discussed,
or there will be no... Greece still be part of it?
Or there will be no Euro. Certainly we will not muddle through for 60 more years on the Euro. I think it will still be seen as a project that attempts to overcome the shadows, because those shadows of the past, you know, are not beaten forever, and they can come back any moment. And I think we have to all work on preventing that this will come back.
Heather Graby, are you confident we could still have this conversation in 60 years from now?
We'll certainly be still be having a conversation about Europe. The question is, what will the shape be like, and where will powers lie at different levels of government? I think there will still be some form of European integration. Winston Churchill remarked that democracy was the worst form of government, except all the others that have been tried from time to time. And we found that the European Union is perhaps the worst form of resolving differences and resolving common problems, except for all the others that we've tried over various centuries on the continent of Europe. So given that we've managed 60 years of peace and rising prosperity and security, which is a pretty rare achievement across the span of European history, I hope we'll still manage to have some shadow of that, at least over the next 60 years.
Daniel Hannan, the UK is leaving. Will 27 others have followed in the next 60 years?
I mean, you know, at 60, I think the EU is showing its age. It's creaky and stiff and a little bit sclerotic. And what I mean by that is that it is enshrining a lot of the old de regis, top-down traditions that were current in the 1950s but have lived on in Brussels in a way that they haven't in democratic nation states. So the European Union, if it carries on this path, I don't think is going to be here for another 60 years. So far, it's shown no willingness to repatriate powers to its member countries, to decentralize, to diffuse power. That was put, it seems to me, completely beyond doubt in the renegotiation process. That was the one opportunity when it might have happened, and it didn't. You know, what I think has succeeded, rather than the European Customs Union, is the European Free Trade Association. I can't help noticing that people in Norway and Switzerland, who are, according to the UN, the happiest people in the world, and are, according to the Legatum Institute, the richest people in the world, have made a success out of being in a free trade area without a political union.
Thomas Vlasek, a free trade area might survive 60 years, but the European Union won't.
I surely hope it does, because, frankly, the alternatives are too awful to contemplate. I found the notion that if the EU goes away, it will be replaced by happy, sovereign, free nations. They will freely trade with each other and grow richer. Completely naive. There's very little, virtually nothing, in a 1,000-year history of Europe that would support that notion. And I certainly see no other replacement, with all the caveats that Heather mentioned. It's not a perfect union, but I certainly see no other replacement for the sort of organization that has forced the governments to think in a far broader definition of the national interest, that has built this communal spirit. I think it's been hugely important for keeping the possibility of strife within Europe at bay. For all those reasons, I hope it is certainly still around.
We are going to have to leave it there. I'd like to thank our panel, Heather Graby, Guntram Wolf, Tomasz Vlasek and Daniel Hannan. Thank you all very much. Thank you also to Carnegie Europe for hosting us this evening. Thank you all for coming. That's The World Tonight. I'm Rithula Shah. Good evening. You can also find more BBC podcasts at bbc.co.uk/podcasts.